Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. We're looking back at the big stories of 2017, which began with Donald Trump becoming the 45th president of the United States.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
The president makes good on a number of promises, but he remains historically unpopular, besieged by an investigation into possible Russian electioneer collusion. Meanwhile, nuclear fears escalate. North Korean state television announced last month that Pyongyang test-fired a long-range intercontinental missile that could reach the U.S.
화성 15형 시험 발사가 성공적으로 진행되었다.
And at home, the debate over gun rights and gun control heats up after more deadly mass shootings. In October, a gunman opens fire on concertgoers in Las Vegas, killing 58 and wounding hundreds more.
He was shooting everybody, and there was dead people everywhere, and I don't even know what was happening. He was just shooting randomly.
And allegations of sexual harassment from Hollywood to Washington spawned the movement hashtag MeToo. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable looks back at 2017, the year in the news. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story of 2017? Is it the Trump presidency? The Russia probe? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Karen Tumulty. She's national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, great to have you with us and happy almost New Year.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
And from cold, chilly Vermont is David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. David, thanks for being with us. Great pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Anthony. I'm watching the snow fall as we speak.
Ah, sounds lovely. And also from chilly, cold New England, from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Jack, always a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome.
Hello, Anthony, Karen, and David.
So let's start with Donald Trump. In so many ways, 2017 was dominated by President Trump's first year in office. So let's begin there and let's get a little of his voice into this conversation. Here he is at the Conservative Political Action Conference in February, going after what he describes as fake news.
I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
Enemy of the people. So, folks, here's a president who, on the one hand, seems disorganized in many ways, to shoot from the hip, but he's also a president who is a master showman, who knows how to dominate the news cycle. He is the tweeter-in-chief. So the big question about 2017, Karen Tumulty, I'll start with you. How did Trump use the year to redefine how we view the presidency?
That is the exact question to be asking. You know, we all went into this assumption that the office changes the man, because that's what we've always seen happen before. But the Donald Trump that we saw as president was strikingly like the Donald Trump we saw as a presidential candidate. He still continued to communicate the way he did. He continued to make decisions the way he did as a candidate. It continues to inspire his base. The problem is that it has also left him at the end of the year with the lowest approval ratings of any president we have ever seen at this point in his presidency. And he has not been able to sort of expand his reach beyond the people who voted for him in the first place.
David Sanger, same question to you. Give us the sort of quick David Sanger reaction to Donald Trump and how he shaped 2017.
Well, Karen's right, as usual, and what you saw during the campaign is what you got in year one. What strikes me, not only domestically, but particularly around the world, is that you have seen the U.S. retreat more from treaties back to its borders than you have seen it get out and advocate new programs, fill the vacuum of the world with American power. So you've seen the president leave the Paris Climate Accord. You've seen him leave the just about completed Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have been a trade deal that included everybody except China and put China on the way, on the ropes a little bit. You have seen the president threaten NATO to pull back. You've seen the president go to renegotiate NAFTA with the threat that he would pull back. What you haven't seen are many new initiatives in foreign aid, in nonproliferation, in environment, obviously. And so the question that the first year leaves us is the United States at this point a voluntarily diminishing power?
Jack, what do you think? Is the United States voluntarily diminishing, or are we seeing Trump making good on his promise to put America first, as he said on Inauguration Day?
Yes, he didn't follow that up with sort of a logical corollary to it, which is America first can be America alone. And I think we've seen a lot of that. But to pick up on Karen's point about the campaign being prelude to the presidency, I'm struck with how even formulations offered by his Republican opponents seem to be paradigms for looking at the administration. Jeb Bush, he said, the chaos candidate will be a chaos president. I think that's a pretty fair way of looking at the presidency we've had. Ted Cruz, he said he called Trump a, quote, pathological liar. Well, I don't know about pathological. Maybe it's deliberate, but certainly the president has told many lies. Trump's own words have been prophetic and prelusive. Even in his announcement in 2015, his announcement of his candidacy, he indulged in a kind of barstool, benighted bigotry, talking about Mexicans coming across the borders and saying that there were some good ones, some of them are good people. Just the formula of sort of, as I say, a kind of benighted bigotry. And we've seen that. But who could have predicted that penchant for touching on ethnic stereotypes and exacerbating racial divisions, that would lead to him to even see a moral equivalence between demonstrators at Charlottesville and Klan neo-Nazis. That couldn't have been predicted. And finally, one other prediction made on this program shortly after he was inaugurated was by Beverly Gage, the Yale historian. She said she thought the big story of the Trump presidency would be the reaction it aroused. And you can argue that we have seen a lot of that reaction so far, certainly in the polls, in some of the elections, and looking ahead to 2018.
Let's go to Jay, who's calling from Wallingford, Connecticut. Jay, good to have you on the show.
Hi, Andy. How you doing?
Very well.
Well, I just want to put this point out there for the people, is that everybody these days is too sensitive about things, and they try to just mask the truth, you know? Well, you got to see is this country is to the minimum it could be when it comes to resources, money, any of that. So the only way that we're going to be able to move ahead, and we all know it, we're going to end up going to war. People don't understand that. You want to put our new president down like he's nobody. He's actually moving. He's moving the pieces the right way it needs to be, because you can't hide the inevitable, and you can't run away from something that's going to happen. And we need to take care of the situation before it comes to us. You know?
So, Jay, there a vote for Donald Trump moving things in the right direction. And dear panel, I want to sort of put that idea out there because, You know, I was looking at a piece by Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post, the 10 best things Trump has done in his first year in office. I'm not going to read them all, but here are a few. He recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, as he promised. He withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement, as he promised. He created historic tax and regulatory reform, as he said he would. He installed conservative judges who will preside over the courts for decades, including Neil Gorsuch at the Supreme Court. So, Karen Tumulty, I mean, if you are part of Trump's base, you're looking at a pretty good year, aren't you?
I except for one big omission, and it was the signature promise that Republicans made in 2016, which is repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And we saw that when it comes to the legislative arena, when it comes to achieving really big things with Congress, having put both branches of government in Republican hands, that's where the difficulty comes. And it wasn't until the very end of this year that you saw a big Republican accomplishment in the form of a big tax cut.
So the tax cut, of course, was a big deal. But to say a little bit more, Karen, about Obamacare, because we did see multiple assaults in Obamacare. They fizzled out. But then in that tax bill, of course, they managed to get rid of the individual mandate. As you sit there in Washington, where does Obamacare stand? How does it look? I mean, are Republicans going to take another run at it in the new year?
This individual mandate was something. It is the requirement that if you don't already receive health care coverage, say, through your employer, you have to go out and buy it somewhere or pay a penalty. This was something that, for instance, President Obama did not support when he was a candidate. But ultimately, he came to the belief that the whole system couldn't work without it. I think that we have to see how well the whole structure holds up without it. And, you know, this is probably the Republicans' last chance until the election to make a run at it.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about the year's top stories. You can join the conversation. Does Donald Trump's tweeting give us a front row seat to his governing style? Does the travel ban keep the country safer? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined by David Sanger of the New York Times, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And folks, let's talk a little bit about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians in the lead up to the 2016 election. This obviously a big story throughout 2017 and promises to be one into the new year as well. So last May, former FBI Director James Comey told members of the Senate Intelligence Committee that he had no doubt Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election.
There should be no fuzz on this whatsoever. The Russians interfered in our election during the 2016 cycle. They did it with purpose. They did it with sophistication. They did it with overwhelming technical efforts. And it was an active measures campaign driven from the top of that government.
And now, since then, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation has charged four people close to Trump, including the former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, his former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, Rick Gates, a longtime business associate of Manafort's, and former Trump campaign foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos. David Sanger, let me come to you with this. Where do you see this investigation standing now, and where do you see it going in 2018?
Well, Anthony, you've got to divide the investigation into sort of three different issues. The first is the cyber interference by the Russians, mm-hmm. which the president briefly acknowledged just about a year ago when he was presented with the full intelligence report at Trump Tower by James Clapper and John Brennan and, of course, by the FBI director who he later fired, Mr. Comey. And after that, after being presented with the evidence, which includes intercepts that made it very clear that this was coming from the very top leadership in the Kremlin, including President Vladimir Putin, he briefly acknowledged it and then has backed away from that. Why? Because he fears, as many of his aides will tell you, that if he acknowledges the Russian involvement, it somehow casts into doubt the legitimacy of his presidency. Now, a lot of other people would say, no, you could stand up and say, I was legitimately elected. I won in the Electoral College fairly decisively. And even if it was a narrow election, there's no evidence that the vote itself was manipulated, only that there were efforts to go influence opinion in the election. That wouldn't be the first time. And something the United States has done. And then for the president to stand up and say, we can never let this happen again and appoint a presidential commission, and we'd be on our way to preventing this from happening in 2018 or again in 2020 during the next presidential election. That didn't happen.
Hmm.
And I think maybe one of the biggest stories of the year is the dog that didn't bark here, which is the U.S. getting itself organized to make sure that this kind of manipulation can't happen again. The second part is the question of whether or not there was, as you referred to it, as collusion, and what lawyers would say is whether or not there was a conspiracy of any kind, because collusion is not a crime. And on that, the president keeps saying, and said again in this sort of bizarre impromptu interview he gave to my colleague Mike Schmidt in the club room of his one of his golf courses.
This was just yesterday, right, David?
Right. And yeah. Where else would you find the president for an interview but in the clubhouse of a golf course? As he said, there's no collusion. There's no collusion. Everyone agrees there's no collusion. Well, we don't know that yet. But even if there was collusion, it's not entirely clear that that would be criminal. But what worries the White House is that Mueller is not limited to just that. He can go back and look at financial transactions. He can go look at the Trump Organization before the president served as president. And, of course, he can look at obstruction of justice. And the history of past investigations like this is, you know, it's the cover-up, not the crime, as the old saying goes. And the firing of Comey itself may prove to be the issue that Mueller goes and focuses on. And then there's the last question, which is, what's the political impact of these House and Senate investigations? The House one has gone completely off the rails and is now, you know, focusing in on a uranium deal allegedly involving Hillary Clinton that people have looked at and investigated and does not appear to have been within Mrs. Clinton's prerogative to go decide. The Senate investigation is a serious one, and that's the investigation to look at.
And Karen Tumulty, pick it up there and talk a little bit about where this goes in 2018. And if you want to pick up on David's point that the Senate investigation is one to focus on, start there or anywhere you want.
Well, I do think that the main investigation to focus on remains Bob Mueller's. And the president was very hopeful, in fact, apparently had been assured by his legal team that this investigation was very close to wrapping up and that he would be exonerated. That became clear that it was not going to happen on December 1st when we discovered that the former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, had actually pleaded guilty to a relatively minor charge, considering everything that he could have been charged with, which was a pretty clear sign that he is cooperating with the investigators. So this is going to drag on, and this is what truly seems to drive the president to distraction, and I think is going to continue to dominate a lot of the news as we move into this very critical midterm election season.
And I want to talk about that midterm election in just a bit. But let me just stick with this Robert Mueller's investigation. And you know, David Sanger made reference to the New York Times impromptu interview with Donald Trump in his clubroom down at Mar-a-Lago. Karen, I want to ask you about that, because he sort of contradicted what members of his own party have been doing, which is to wage a bit of a campaign to discredit Robert Mueller. But here's President Trump saying, no, he believes Mueller will treat him fairly. What did you make of that?
Well, it almost sounded like, given all the speculation that he might fire Mueller, it almost sounded like a warning.
Oh, in other words, treat me fairly or else.
Exactly. And then he makes the rather unusual argument that this is somehow making America look bad around the world.
Very interesting. Jack, what did you make of that New York Times interview?
Yes, exactly what Karen said. That was my reading as well. That was a Trumpian warning in the guise of a sort of statesmanlike concession. Oh well, no, he means to be fair. He was saying be fair, and what fair means we're going to see. You know, many people think that the story of the year, and David alluded to it with the House committee, is that the House. That there are signals that even if Mr. Mueller comes down with a heavy, list of connections between the Trump campaign, perhaps even the president himself, and Russia, that the House is not going to talk about impeachment. That they're just going to say, "Well, it's a rigged election. Mueller is a Hillary Clinton plant." Or there are just clear signals of that, and of course. What that does, and the Washington Post reports it this morning, Trump's aides have warned him that if the Democrats win in 2018, impeachment is going to be one of the things they pursue, almost certainly. And if Mueller comes up with something before the election and the Republicans say, well, we don't see anything there, and anyway, Mueller is tainted, we have a kind of constitutional crisis. One branch of government isn't doing what the Constitution said it should do, which is to hold the other branch to account, and the election will be about that, should the president be impeached or not.
Let's go to Frederick, who's calling from Brunswick, Maine. Frederick, you're on the air. It's great to have you.
Greetings, Anthony, and guests. Happy New Year to all.
Happy New Year to you.
I wanted to say that I feel, with all due respect, that you've, of course, missed the tremendous pushback against this administration. Now, you did mention that it wasn't until just this month that the conservative-led White House and Congress was finally able to claim any form of success. And I feel that you and NPR ought to really have a focus on what is known as the indivisible grassroots movement. Now, you may not know that there are more than 6,000 chapters. There are people organized in every congressional district. And here in this little community along the mid-coast of Maine, there are more than 400 people. By the way, I would say that it is because of Indivisible that our Senator Susan Collins has, well, on the one hand, stood for the people of Maine and the dire need of health care. Unfortunately, she turned her back on the citizens and voted for this horrible tax cut. But let's not forget that.
Frederick, I'm going to pick this point. I'm glad you put this point on the table, and we're going to pick it up. And basically what you're talking about is sort of grassroots pushback and the reaction to Donald Trump. And it's indeed a subject that I wanted to get to. So I'm going to put it to our panelists. And folks, let's talk about that, because we saw Democrats win the governorship in Virginia. We saw a Republican majority in the House of Delegates in Virginia erase. And then, as Frederick mentioned, we saw Democrat Doug Jones win a special election in Ruby Red, Alabama. So talk about the significance of these events and where it leaves Republicans and the president. And let me start with you, David, your view of this grassroots pushback and what it portends for 2018.
I think the only way you can view a grassroots pushback is as preparation for the 2018 election and ultimately for the 2020 election. Now, when you talk to people who are involved in what they call the resistance, you find a couple of interesting things. The first is there's a subset of them, a fairly large subset, who want to discuss impeachment. And they want to discuss that even ahead of hearing the results of the investigations, because they believe that the activities the president's engaged in the past year are in and of themselves impeachable. Interesting question to ask, which is if and this is more Karen's territory than mine, but if the Democrats won back the House and Senate, one of the two, but particularly in the House, in 2018, I think there'd be overwhelming pressure to go vote out articles of impeachment. And the question is, would that prove so divisive in a country that's already incredibly divided that it might actually hurt the Democrats' chances in 2020.
Huh, interesting. Interesting. Let me ask you about that, Karen. And I want to sort of throw out a couple of facts that I came up here. So to win to win a majority in the House, Democrats need to win 24 seats now held by Republicans. And here are a couple of facts from the Gallup organization. Historically, when a president has a 50% approval rating or better, the party loses an average of 14 seats. When presidents are below that mark, the party loses 36 seats. So Trump, as we know, has an historically low approval rating below 40%. So history would suggest that Democrats have a pretty good chance of winning back the House. What do you see, Karen, in 2018 in the midterms?
I think that the opportunities are certainly there, but you looking at the national numbers doesn't really tell you as much as kind of looking at these individual House races. And the ones to really concentrate on are those 23 seats where there is a Republican in Congress but is sitting in a district that voted for Hillary Clinton. These are the seats that are in most danger of flipping, but they are also probably pretty moderate, even conservative areas. And that is why people like Nancy Pelosi, who certainly understands this math very well, has been arguing that this push to sort of get every candidate to declare whether he or she would support impeachment is something that may actually be counterproductive to the sort of very practical job of trying to win back the House. This is going to be hand-to-hand combat in districts across the country. Sometimes, often in the past, it's been helped by a wave, but these candidates have got to go out there and win their individual districts.
Jack Beatty, you know, if there's anything that the first year of President Trump has demonstrated, it's that conventional political predictions are a risky business. So I'm curious, what might we be missing in the year ahead? I mean, the conventional wisdom would be that Democrats are energized. This will be a wave election. Republicans might be in a defensive crouch. The Trump White House is scrambling and ill-prepared for the political tsunami that's going to come. But really? I mean, what might we be missing that might be completely unpredictable in 2018?
Well, we might be missing 3% economic growth. You know, it's been above 3% for a couple of quarters now. This tax cut certainly isn't going to hold it back. And that's, I think, the president's, if you will, trump card for the election. Look, times are good. Now, times may be good for the stock market, and times will be good for, wealthier Americans who can really see big cuts in their taxes. Will they be good enough for the sort of Trump base voter, the, white, rural, often male voter? The evidence on that is kind of mixed. President Obama in his stimulus program actually gave a bigger tax cut to ordinary people than Trump is, than Trump has just done. And yet, polls show that people didn't even notice it. They didn't give him any credit for it. It wasn't. People said, "What do you mean? What tax cut? I barely noticed anything in my." Will that $80 or whatever it is in your paycheck every 2 weeks, or maybe every week, is that going to translate into, by gosh, times are good? We'll have to see. One of the things we've seen in America, though, in recent decades is the bifurcated economy. Great stock market, wonderful earnings for the corporations, vast wealth for the few, while the many have really fallen behind.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're looking back at the big stories of 2017. In other news this year, President Trump confounded the Twitter sphere in June when he coined a new word. Samantha Bee weighed in.
Covfefe. Trump is right. He really does have the best words. And he spelled it right. V before E, except after Z.
I missed that one. In September, Hurricane Maria plunged Puerto Rico into darkness, and much of the island has yet to recover. Here was Governor Ricardo Rossello.
The most devastating storm, either in a century or quite frankly, in modern history.
And legendary father of rock and roll Chuck Berry died in March at the age of 90. Here he is with one of his most recognizable guitar licks in history from Johnny B. Goode.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Berry, one of the many great musicians who left us in this past year. You can join the conversation. Did Hurricane Harvey, Irma, and Maria make you think differently about climate change? Has the national opioid crisis touched you? And my guests this hour are Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, David Sanger of The New York Times, and On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. And let's get a call. Robert is calling from Central City, Kentucky. Robert, it's great to have you. What's on your mind?
Hey, hello, Anthony.
Hello.
My question was, with the resistance to Trump and all the backlash that's been going on, I wonder if anybody has even considered the economic consequences if they did succeed in impeaching him.
Well, it's a great question, Robert. And Jack Beattie, you were just making this very point before the break, that this sort of might be one of the unforeseen things in 2018, especially when you talk to folks who support the president.
Prosperity, yes. Yeah. And that's a powerful argument. And that's one of the trinity of things that political scientists look at when they, when they make their forecasts, how many seats the president's party will lose. And that's up in the air. I think the bigger problem, though, and David alluded to this, perhaps even crisis that impeachment, even proceedings could introduce, is that, on Trump TV, all of this is going to seem like some great conspiracy to deny the results of the election. If you watch Fox News, it's all conspiracy of Mueller and the Democrats and witch hunt all the time. Hmm. And that mindset, people who feed on that diet, and there are millions, are not going to accept that Robert Mueller is giving a fair bill, and they're certainly not going to accept that the Democrats are fair. That could be a terrible moment for the country, where the Democrats, feel their voters want him to go ahead with articles of impeachment, or at least have hearings, and the Mueller investigation gives them evidence. But you get this tremendous reaction from the Trump world that you're trying to nullify our election.
Well, that indeed could be a big story in 2018, although I hasten to add, I'm always loath to make those kinds of predictions. But I want to move on. We've been spending most of the hour talking about domestic affairs. I want to talk about tensions with North Korea, China's rise, and sort of what 2017 did look like on the foreign front. This year, many of us were frightened by North Korean ICBM tests and President Trump trading insults with Kim Jong-un. During a speech at the United Nations General Assembly in September, President Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
There's President Trump speaking to the UN General Assembly in September. David Sanger, the Trump administration has placed a lot of effort on trying to get China to tame North Korea. What do we see in 2017, and where do we stand right now with this, arguably, this huge crisis?
It is, and it's been, sort of the slow-running Cuban Missile Crisis. This is if you took the Cuban Missile Crisis and you stretched it out over 20 years. But what happened this year, starting in May, is that we got a series of surprises that made us realize that things people had been warning about for two decades were actually happening. So for years, North Korea has been attempting to build nuclear weapons. I started covering this in the late 1980s when I was still living as a Times correspondent in Japan. And in 2006, they exploded their first nuclear weapon. That was 11 years ago. But this year, they did something that we still thought was years away, which was explode something that had the power of a thermonuclear weapon, and probably was. That would probably be about 15 times greater power than the bomb that the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima. Hmm. But secondly, they finally succeeded in launching intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, they haven't demonstrated one right off of, the coast of California. Instead, quite carefully. They sent them on these very high parabolas into space and back down. But in early summer, they did a distance that could reach Guam. Then in late summer, they did a distance that could reach the West Coast. And in late November, right after Thanksgiving, they did an 8,100-mile shot that clearly could, the missile that clearly could reach as far as New York or Washington. What we don't know at this point is whether or not they can shrink a nuclear weapon and make it survive reentry into the atmosphere. But if they can't do it now, Anthony, they're clearly not very far away from that.
And so, David, what do you see in 2018 in terms of, I mean, well, let me put the question this way, what you hope the Trump administration will do to confront North Korea over this issue?
So there are basically three big options, Anthony. Number one is to basically do what every president before has done, which is say it's intolerable, but basically accept it.
Because what can they do?
Right. And, you know, this is the same debate the United States played out in 1963, 1964, when the question was, could you tolerate a China with nuclear weapons, or do we have to go out and destroy their test sites? And there was serious discussion, first in the Kennedy administration, then in the Johnson administration, about whether to do it. And, you know, we're all here years later. But there are many in the Trump administration who say, hey, look, North Korea is not like China. And Kim Jong-un, once he has this weapon, will use it for blackmail or worse. And the president himself has said not only can't North Korea be contained, we would have to act if we thought we were threatened by a North Korean missile. Well, we already are. So then the question is, what kind of action is it? And it's possible that sanctions might make a difference, but the CIA's own estimate is no amount of sanction is going to get North Korea to give up a weapon system it considers to be existential. Then the question is, do you take military action? And if you do, can you control the escalation, keep Seoul from being destroyed? Every American president beforehand has said, no, we can't really take that bet. We don't know how Donald Trump's going to view that. And the third possibility is that you go through a year kind of like we had of constant threats back and forth. But the problem with that is sooner or later there's going to be an incident, an encounter at sea with a North Korean ship, something over the DMZ. And you have to be ready, both with your allies and the Chinese, to be able to keep that from escalating into a broader war. So what's clear right now is we can't sit on the status quo.
Boy, doesn't sound like a particularly appetizing menu of options. Lots to worry about in 2018. Let's go to Charlie, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia, with a question about North Korea. Charlie, you're on the air. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. I think David Sanger is exactly correct, and I think what we're looking forward to here is another Tonkin Gulf incident, such as occurred in 1964 with the USS Maddox and the USS Turner Joy, which reported attacks by North Vietnamese ships, which didn't happen, and allowed President Johnson to present the Tonkin Gulf resolution, which ended up with 58,000 American dead and something like 2 to 3 million Vietnamese dead. We have three nuclear carrier groups in the waters off North Korea. We are acting in a very provocative manner ourselves, and we are getting ready to have a little tiny incident, which in a fraction of just a wink of an eye, 25 million people in Seoul and the surrounding area are going to be dead from conventional weapons fired from North Korea before North Korea is destroyed by the United States, which very well could trigger a worldwide thermonuclear war. And Donald Trump is going to blunder his way into it.
All right, Charlie, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, are you as pessimistic as we heard Charlie there? Do you fear blundering into a thermonuclear war?
I do. I don't know about thermonuclear, but certainly a war on the Korean Peninsula, and recent reporting augments that anxiety. The Daily Telegraph and our friend Olivier Knox in Yahoo News have both reported recently of former U.S. officials and current ones warning that the administration is considering a military strike, a, quote, bloody nose, at the missile sites in North Korea. And then there's this ominous comment from Lindsey Graham. He said, he, President Trump, told me this to my face. Quote, if thousands die, they're going to die over there. They're not going to die over here. Well, I'm sure that's welcome news to the South Koreans. If the president said that, if that's his mindset, let them die over there rather than die over here, that's a frightening situation. Adding to that, his domestic crisis. If the Mueller investigation gets worse and worse, the president is going to be sorely tempted to either act preemptively in North Korea or, you know, not to look the other way at a provocation. He might be looking for a foreign adventure or crisis as a way out of his domestic difficulties.
Karen, I'd like to ask you about that. I wanted to sort of bring this up, and that is the possible confluence of domestic pressure in the form of the Mueller investigation with an overseas crisis. How do you see that playing out? I mean, Jack laid out a pretty grim scenario there. What do you see?
I think no one knows how to see that playing out, in part because we don't really have any sense of what a Trump doctrine in foreign policy would be. He has been erratic in his statements, often contradicts himself one day to the next, which makes other world leaders sort of confused about what to expect from him, when to take him seriously. He has he has been critical of our allies. He has cozied up to some of our adversaries. You take all of those ingredients, and it really makes it impossible to predict, which is one of the most destabilizing sort of things you could do in a situation like this in the world.
Let's go to Anita. She's calling from West Newbury, Vermont. Hi, Anita. You're on the air. It's good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. I'm an American who's lived in Switzerland for the past 38 or 40 years.
Lucky you.
And I am hurt when I see the European press talk about our president, and I totally agree with the press, as a liar and an egomaniac and an ignorant person, as a threat to world peace. And I don't think that most Americans realize that that's the attitude of at least Europe and other parts of the world as well.
Well, Anita, let me take that point because we're up against the clock. But let me put it to David Sanger because, you know, David, when I hear Anita's point, you know, I have this general question about U.S. foreign policy and Trump's vision of America first. I mean, it seems 2017 saw the U.S. straining relationships with traditional Western allies, including Germany, Great Britain, while somehow appearing to cozy up to traditional adversaries, including Russia and China. I mean, what do you make of this?
I think the remarkable thing about the past year has been that the president's America First strategy has put him in the position of challenging allies to go, in his words, you know, pay their fair share. And he said this outright in the interviews that Maggie Haberman and I did with him during the campaign in 2016, and he followed through with it this year. There's nothing wrong with pressuring the allies. The difficulty has been that he views the world in very transactional terms, the kind of transactional terms that you would expect of somebody who spent their life in real estate, where most deals are transactional. They're not about building relationships. And that has had a corrosive effect. Has it a permanent corrosive effect? We don't know. Maybe a new president coming in, you know, 3 years from now or 7 years from now would be able to repair that damage fairly quickly. The oddity has been his embrace of dictators, and not just Putin and not just Xi Jinping. I should say authoritarians. But even, say, the president of the Philippines, who in a telephone conversation he had that was later leaked when the Filipinos leaked the transcript of it, he was complimentary of what has basically been extrajudicial killings of suspected drug dealers, and we know those killings have gone well beyond just drug dealers. There is something missing in that part of American foreign policy that has typically stood up for due process and human rights, because the president views authoritarians as people who can get things done, and we can go do business with, and he doesn't have to worry about messy democracies voting down ideas he's got. And that's his problem, essentially, with the Europeans.
Well, it's been quite a year, much more to come in 2018. I somehow wish we could have left listeners maybe with a bit more hope for 2018, but there it is. David Sanger of the New York Times, great to have you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and even to Jack, you know, who we're going to give a visa to Vermont over from his...
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Have a happy New Year. It's always great
and
to hear
you. And to you and all our listeners.
And Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, thanks so much for being with us, and best to you for a happy New Year.
Thank you so much. Happy 2018.
Yes. Listeners, thank you for listening this year. We'll be back next year. Here's to a safe, happy, and peaceful New Year. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.